Okay, glad to be here. As I told Mike, I got quite a few slides today, so let's hope I don't keep you here too long since we started a little bit late. But I want to go over the importance of quality control and quality assurance in airborne measurements and take examples from the field project work that I've been involved in over the last several years. And I'd like to show you how exciting this work can be, but yet how much care it takes to come out of the field and into the analysis phase of your work with some high quality measurements. So I like to start by going back, and we are scientists, but sometimes I think we lose track of the basic foundation of science is the scientific method. And that consists of a correction of data through observation and experiments. So that's the important part that I want to focus on today, is the observations and the experiments that we do. And that leads to formulation, testing of hypothesis. And that's the method that we all go by in our research. So I want to focus on the first part of this, the high quality experiments and observations that go along with them that then we use to formulate our theories. And I'll focus on airborne data sets. And the thesis I want to develop is that airborne data sets that are not quality controlled and quality assured result in beliefs and formations of incorrect hypotheses. So I'll give you some examples of that and how that can be the case. So try to build that thesis up throughout this lecture today. Please jump in if you got any questions, if I go too fast, or if I tell you skip over something. So the objective here is to illustrate the process of tools we use to create airborne data sets. I'll go over three different data sets. We have the POLCAST 2 data set from North Dakota that we did last summer. And then I have some measurements from our work in West Africa and Mali, and then from the work in Saudi Arabia, both last year and this year. And I use this to provide examples of how poor airborne data sets can result in inaccurate scientific conclusions, and hence demonstrate why it's important to have high quality data sets to make progress. So we want to make some progress in understanding the scientific questions that we confront, and not just go out and correct data just to correct data and write papers just to write papers. So I'll go through a couple definitions here. I already said it before, quality control and quality assurance. In atmospheric science, these are used somewhat differently in different subfields. So I want to be clear what I mean. Quality control is a process of conducting tests to check that measurements are being made correctly and accurately. So I look at this as what we do in the field when you're making the measurements. You know, make sure that you have your instrument coupled to the environment. Make sure the instrument is performing accurately. And then we have quality assurance is a process of reviewing the data to eliminate measurements that are invalid, that is caused by some known problem. You know, if something happens, your instrument doesn't work, you want to flag that so that you don't use that in your analysis. This can start right, even during the measurements, right after, which we typically review the data right after the flight. So it starts on the flight, it starts right after the flight, but the majority of the work is done once we come back from the field. We spent a lot of time this summer working in the 422 lab. If you see some students or some of the students here, you know, that's a lot of what we do is look at the data after the fact and do the quality assurance. In the field, for example, this is Robert Mitchell that came to Saudi Arabia in the spring with me. He's running some of these calibration beads. So he has a jar of these beads, and if you come up here, you look at it, it's a bunch of fine white powder that we ran through the instrument, but these are of known size. So you do a check on the performance of, in this case, an FSSP, a crowd probe, to see that it's sizing the particles correctly. So this is the difference of what I mean by quality control and quality assurance. So I'd like to go over now, show you some of the aircraft that we worked with and some of the instruments that are on the aircraft. So when we go out and make airborne measurements, we don't just look out the window and look at clouds. We need very sophisticated instruments to make the observations. So this is from Bamako in West Africa in 2007. We used a Cheyenne 2, which is this aircraft here. We had two PMS cans, we call it, where we can put instruments in, one on the left wing, one on the right wing of the aircraft. So this one here is called a Forward Scattering Spectrometer Probe. This is to measure cloud droplet concentrations from about 3 to 50 microns in diameter. This was always flown on a probe. On the other wing of the aircraft, we have a PCASP, which measures aerosol concentrations. It's an optical particle counter. Measures aerosols, with the dust particles in the atmosphere between 0.1 micron and 3 microns in diameter. And we would switch this PCASP out with a 2DC probe, a two-dimensional cloud droplet probe. This one would give us images of larger cloud droplet, up to a millimeter in size. And we'd switch out between these two depending on the flight mission we're doing it. If we're interested in measuring the aerosols, we'll use the PCAS down lower. If we're interested in looking at ice and stuff, we use the 2DC. Along with that, we had a cloud condensation nuclei counter. Hopefully now everybody's... we covered from the cloud physics exam yesterday, and you did hopefully know what a cloud condensation nuclei counter is, or a cloud condensation nuclei. So this is one of the instruments we use to measure the aerosols that water droplets, water vapor condense onto. And this sits inside the aircraft. We bring the air into the instrument. We have a data acquisition system to acquire all this data. So we have one of these up in the 423 lab right now. So we make these observations with an aircraft. So that was the aircraft we used in 2007. 2008, we had a larger aircraft. This was a King Air 200. Basically, we could carry 4 instruments instead of the 2 that we had the previous year. So always nicer to have more instruments, or usually nicer to have more instruments. We added an Ames probe to measure 3-dimensional winds, and we could carry both the 2DC and the FSSP at the same time. The other aircraft also had a couple other ones, a temperature probe, total temperature probe, and a DMT hot wire probe for measuring liquid water. In 2008, we switched to using a new DMT, droplet measurement technologies, cloud condensation nuclei counter. So this is it's a new commercially available instrument to measure CCN concentrations. And so one of the things we've been doing in the lab is comparing these two instruments, and we did a little bit of lab work on that. And so we always want to move the technology forward.
Dave, I have a curious question. Why is do the measurement, do you think there's a propeller can impact your sensor measurement?
Yes, there's issues with, it's basically a coupling issue. So we have the props here, and they are issues. And one of the things we did on this aircraft is the easiest place to put the inlets. These ones are outside the flow of the aircraft, so they're out here. But you see the exhaust of the engines right here. And so we're making CCN measurements. And there was concern that the exhaust could influence the measurement, because the easiest place to put the measurement is right on the side of the aircraft where we could take out the window. So we did work starting here. We never got it to successfully do it, but we did successfully do a test flight in Saudi Arabia in the spring. I think Gokhan was on the flight where we basically we did sampling from the window location and then also from the top of the aircraft to see if there's a difference between them, if we're detecting any aerosols from the engine. And the conclusion from that flight was that we were not detecting the engine exhaust. But you have to be very careful about the placement of these instruments and also how you couple them. So that's what I would refer to as a quality control check, is we check to see that are we sampling what we want to sample and not sampling the engine exhaust and not being influenced by the props. Also, the Ames probe has a lot of coupling issues with it, particularly being out here, how is it affected by the wind and stuff. So these are things to take into account when you make the measurements. And we spent like a whole flight just testing that one case to do that. And I'll show you on the next aircraft where we did it. But we basically sampled from both of them. And one of my students, Karen, she did the analysis for that this summer to show that it wasn't a case. This is from the North Dakota project, the Cessna 340. This is the one that Tony had lots of fun on flying on last summer. And we flew this out of Fargo. Again, a similar set of instruments, but this is, again, a smaller aircraft. We could only carry two probes at one time, two wind-mounted probes. We put a lot of our UND's instruments on here. We had, this is our UND-owned PCAS instrument. We had our own M300 data system. And then I come to this spring when I take my students for a nice, fun spring break. We go to Saudi Arabia and pray in the sand. So this is our aircraft there. So be careful what you wish for. You get fun vacations. So this is a King Air. It's a different one than the one we had in Maui, but it's same model as 200. And again, it's instrumented. This one has four PMS pods, and we have a different type of Ames. But we have a DMT counter, and it's the same one we used in Maui to do that. And again, temperature probe is there. So them on the aircraft, them on the measurements, some of the instruments, we can go in a lot of details about how they work. But I want to move on and talk a little bit about the Saudi Arabian spring experiment this last spring in 2009. So what's one thing people think about when they think about Saudi Arabia in there? So someone tell me. Oil, okay. Oil, that's the reason they got lots of money so they can fund the research. So Tony said dust, sand. So, you know, if you look at it when you're there, I don't have a picture, but it's pretty barren of vegetation. So here's some sand I brought back from Saudi Arabia. And it's not, it doesn't always stay in the ground. You get wind. So I show you a MODIS image here of the dust. You can see it's over the Arabian Gulf here, across the Saudi Arabian Peninsula here. You can see all this dust. And we worked in Riyadh, which is right about here. And when you're there, you go out in the afternoon, 3, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the sun's starting to get low in the sky, and it looks like almost like the moon, almost like a full moon. It's that much dust in the air that's attenuating the sunlight. So you get this dust in the air, and a lot of times I'm used to field projects where we have a hard time sometimes getting up, taking our measurements because the aircraft can't take off because of severe weather. Storms come through, and it's not safe to take off the aircraft. On this case, we had several days where we couldn't fly because the visibility was so low because of the dust. And I go out there, wow, well, we can go flying today. And I talk to the pilots, and they say, oh, no, visibility, you know, and you can't go fly, yeah.
Would they take off? How good is the dust for those turboprop engines?
I don't know. They didn't really expect any concern about that. It was just the low visibility because they got minimum visibility at the airports and then at the alternates to come and land too. And it went down, you know. And you could see it at the airport. You could see you couldn't see the end of the runway. You know, if you sit at one side, you can't see the other end of the runway. So it would come down on the visibility because of the dust. It's like, you know, it's as bad as fog to reduce the visibility. I don't know. I think ingest the engines. I mean, it's a turboprop engine, but I don't think they had any concern about that flying in it. And again, I think it might be an hourly thing of how long you fly. So, okay, so the dust. And then I got one more example here. Let me see if this will start up. This is downtown Riyadh. Riyadh's a city in central Saudi Arabia that is about 3.5 to 4 million people. That live there. They got a lot of buildings in the downtown area. Let me see. Okay. Give me a second. Maybe it won't start that way. So since we had to wait to get the room, put it here. Now I gotta restart it. Stop. Okay, so you know what? I didn't take this video, but you can go on YouTube and query Saudi Arabia dust in March 2009. This was on March 10th. This is a building. They're taking a picture, a video out of the building, and you can see the dust that's moving across. So this is a March 10th. I mean, it made international news, this dust storm that came across. And this is what it looks like on the ground when you have some of them big dust storms that you see in the satellite. So you would not want to fly when that's happening. Okay, so if you got something like that, and I've been talking about quality control, this happened 5 days before our field project was going to start. So what do you think that, besides not being able to fly, do you think there's any other consequences to these big dust storms? You know, you have this big dust storm. What do you think it does? It blows off the runway. It's not like snow, though. It kind of just blows and blows and dumps in the ocean. I mean, this goes away. But I'm thinking about think about quality control. You know, what do you think this dust does to your instruments? The instruments that we use are mostly all optical instruments. And when this dust comes across, it will get everywhere. And it will get to places where you don't think it will be. I mean, I had not as big as one as this, but you'll be in them buildings, and that dust will get inside the buildings when they come through. And you'll smell it, basically. You'll tell the difference in the air. So it gets everywhere, including inside the optics of the instruments. And because of that reason, it's very difficult for the instruments in that environment. So when I got there, you saw Robert doing the tests of the instruments, like the FSSP. We ran the beads through there, and it's not working. Take the instrument off. Clean the instrument. Put it back on. Still not working. Do it again. You know, we had to do this. And we had to clean it twice very well. We checked the electronics before we could fly on the first day. Because the hangars, We had an outside hangar, so the instruments were covered. We basically put covers over the instruments, but the material, the sand will just get everywhere and will get inside them. So I want to show you an example here from 2007. This was, it's 2007, 2008 field project. So these are what I call performance checks of the FSSP. So this is when you go through, you put the beads through there, and you do the same thing as you would in if you had the instrument in the lab and you were calibrating it. Okay? The difference would be that on these, so we go through, and each one of these dots is on this date we did a performance check of the instrument. And we have a theoretical line here in red that tells you what it should be. So, you know, we do this, we check the instrument and see if it's working. So what do you think the results are? You know, there's a distinct grouping of the data. This is from the winter project, the winter-spring project here, which are not as high as these ones, but they're consistent and stuff. These ones, they should be measured up here. These are channel numbers in the instrument. They should be measured up at 5.5 channels, and they're basically measuring 1 or 2. The dust got so much in the instrument that it does not measure and does not work. And you try to go and analyze your data, and if you use this data, it'll still work. You'll still get data out. But the sizes of the droplets will be different. The concentrations will be different. And if you use that into your analysis, well, that will start. You can always think of a reason that might be the case. So you could think of some odd theories of why you have such low droplet concentrations and such low measurements. But you really need the performance checks to know. Do you have measurements like we did here? Okay. Or do you have measurements that are totally useless? And if you don't do the performance checks, you won't know the difference. And it both go into your data set. These are small particles, so it's a 20-channel instrument, and what we do is we put 15-micron beads in it. So we put beads of a certain size. We take into account the refractive index of the beads, and we know where what channel it should go into. And basically, when we do this, we have different channels, and we measure a particle, and we say, okay, how big is it? And if it's between, say example, between 14 and 16 microns, we stick that into channel 6. If it's between 15 and 17, we stick it in channel 6. If it's 13 to 15, we stick it in channel 5. So the 15 microns should be a little bit less than channel 6. And they will peak. And some of them, it's not a perfect thing, so some of them will go into a little bit higher channels, some will go into lower ones. But on average, they should peak about channel 5 or 6. So we're about a channel low here, which I can adjust in my process, and I can say, okay, well, we're not optimum here, but I can take that and process the data. And you say, well, we're measuring a little bit low, and that shifts everything down, or shifts everything up, and then we don't measure as wide of a range and as what we want. But we can adjust that in our processing. The problem here is basically we're putting 15-micron particles in there, and it's just starting to see them. So it doesn't see things between like 3 and 12 microns. And this is the idea that the particles we're really interested in are like 10 to 15 microns. So you basically, even your total number gets messed up. You know, you don't see a majority of the particles. So yeah, you can adjust it, but you basically lost all your signal. So it's basically useless. And you know, we had some really good case study days that were here, and we started looking at the data, and I said, we wanted to look at what is the FSP? What's the droplet concentration in these crowds to compare with our radar observations and stuff? And we go look at it. We have nothing, you know. So then you stop your analysis. You can't use it. So it's important to know this after the fact when you do this. And here's the results of measurements of the calibrations that we've done in this spring in Saudi Arabia. So again, we're getting measurements 4 to 6, a little bit low. But again, we know what the variability is. We know approximately what the measurement is. Another thing to do this is to see how much scatter you get in your performance and what you expect. So, you know, we don't have measurements at 1 or 2 now. So this data is usable. We can correct for it. We can apply our own calibrations. And we may miss some measurements between 3 and 5 microns. But that's not that important to our observations, and we can deal with that. But we do have the performance checks to verify that, yes, this was performing this well. If you don't do it, then you just don't know. You just take it on faith, or you just say, I mean, better to assume that it's not working. So that's the thing. And this is one of the first things Matt, one of our new graduate students, the first week he was here, he made up this plot for me to look at the analysis of how well the data is. You know, it took me 6 months to make the plot, but that was not to say that I didn't know what the values were. When we did it in real time, you can see approximately what it is. You can know if it's 4 or 5 or if it's 1 or 2. And if it is 1 or 2, then we tell the technicians, take the instrument out, fix the instrument. So, you know, you know it in real time, you fix the instrument in real time, and then you have documentation after the fact of what how well the instruments were performing. Okay, so that's one example. That's quality control of why that's important. Let's move on now to the North Dakota field project, where we basically had a project here last summer. Some of you may have been involved in it. And we flew out of Fargo, North Dakota, and we were targeting crowds for observations within the range of our UND polarimetric radar. So that's why they are north of Fargo. And this is a Google Earth image showing all the flight tracks from our 12 flights that we had during the project. This was in June and July of last year. And I already showed you the instruments that were on here. So, and then we were only targeting crowds in the North Dakota side of the border, because we were doing a randomization seeding experiment where we can see if we can affect the crowd properties by seeding them with hydroscopic flares. So we go out, make all them flights, do a lot of traveling down to Fargo. Then we come up with a data set where you have the dates. We got 12 flights. We get 24.5 hours of flight time. Do some statistics. You got the time periods there. You know, we got flights from less than an hour to up to 3.5 hours on these days. Look at the crowd base heights that we're looking at. You got the temperatures of where we're making our observations of the aerosols and the crowd properties. So you come up with this data set, but then you got to look and see in a quantitative sense how well the measurements are. And so one of the things I look at is this measurement of some preliminary data that we obtain. So one of the instruments on the x-axis here is the optical aerosol concentration. So this is the measurement from the PCASP that we had on the aircraft. So this measures between 0.1 and 3 microns. This is adjusted to standard temperature and pressure in terms of concentrations. So it's a conserved property in terms of vertical variation, kind of like a potential temperature is. So we have that on the x-axis, and then we have another aerosol measurements, which is the crowd condensation nuclei concentration on the y-axis. And what I've done is I put all the data together from the whole project. So this is every observation we have of CCN measurements and the corresponding PCAS measurements. And we did this for the whole project. You see the green line is a one-to-one line. Also, I restricted the data set to only give me data that are out of crowd. So I looked at the FSSP concentration and make sure that we're not in crowds, because the PCAS will measure crowd droplets or be affected by the crowd droplets and give you bad readings, because you really want to look at aerosol particles and not crowd particles. So what's obvious about this prop that might be considered that we want to look at to see about it, to see if it makes sense? Ask the students, what would you think? Does this look like good data? Everything look okay on this? Trying to get some response. Someone. Sometimes the CCN can be higher because the CCN will measure particles less than 0.1 microns. So the PCAS only goes down to 0.1. So you got particles between 20 and 100 nanometers that that were activated CCN. So the CCN concentrations a lot of time is higher. So what else would be that would stand out with this? I think this is all good. So if I do a fit to this data, get a one-to-one fit, and then I come up with a theory that I can predict CCN concentrations based off of the PCAS data. No one's going to tell me? You guys are shy then, or something. So obviously, you look at these data points here, there's 5 data points that are a lot different than the other ones, you know. And of course, you know, you auto scale the axis where you want to show all your data. So, you know, these are a lot different. So usually a lot different measurements are either interesting measurements, which we want to make sure they're right, or they have something wrong with the measurements. And in this case, if you go and look at these measurements in detail, and this is one of the things like Kelsey Watkins and Amy and some other people have done, I had them go through and look for these anomalous, what I call anomalous spikes in the PCAS. So the instrument starts at 0.1 microns, but it's hard for the instrument to measure that first couple channels. And a lot of times what you do is you get high counts in that first one or two channels because of a lot of noise or some dirty optics. And it can happen just part of the fright. And it gives you, if you look at the spectrum, where you look at the size distribution of the aerosols, you look at them, and you got these peaks, and it doesn't make a nice spectrum that you would consider that is real in the atmosphere. So there's a valid reason why these points are considered not valid. So we go through, we look at these spikes, we look and see if that's the case, and then we remove the data from the data sets. And that's part of the quality assurance. So we did that, and then we come up with this plot. So it looks a lot different because we got rid of them big outliers. And you can't just throw out the outliers. I'm not just throwing out the data because they're outliers. What I did was I went back through the data, looked for these spikes, looked at why they caused them, saying that they're not physically realistic. There's no way they could occur in the atmosphere because of what we know about how aerosols are distributed. So it's not just throwing out high data points just to throw out data points. There's valid reasons why we do it. I'll try again. What about these data points?
data is you got a high concentration,
Right there. Oh, she trained is really good. So what's going on right here? You know, we got high counts on the OPC, but very low CCN concentrations. So what happened on this day was these are all from one flight. So this is the June 21st flight. And what was the problem on this flight was there was a leak in our inlet system. So we need to bring this air in from outside into our instrument. And this is a pressurized cabin. So we can't have leaks in our system because then the pressure change is wrong. And the instrument does not perform right. So if you go and look at the data on this day, and you look at the raw measurements, and you know what they're supposed to look like, you'll find that it's inconsistent. The occurrence of where these spikes are in time is inconsistent with how the instrument works. Dave. Yeah, well, you got this one. Yeah, so it's very wide here, but this will point back, I go on to the next one where I remove these, so I remove these ones because of the leak. So let me address that first, and then I'll get back to Dave's comment. So the first thing is you look at that data, and there's a valid reason not to move their measurements. But the other point I want to make here is that it's very important to look at your data as you're taking it. Okay? I mean, look at it in the aircraft, and also look at it after the flight. Because what could have easily happened was, we had developed this leak. This was not at the beginning of our field project. This was after everything was tested, installed the instrument, and it was working. Okay, well, it should work for the whole project, right? Not in this case. So if we didn't check the data, we could have done the next 10 flights with the same problem. And instead of having one flight be bad, you could have only, you could have 90% of your flights be bad. Like the case previously that I showed you with the PCAS, with the FSSP. You know, they were looking at the, they were taking the quality control data, but no one was looking at it. And they weren't experienced enough to know what it should look like in the aircraft. So I wasn't there, and I got there and said, well, have you been taking your quality control measurements? Oh, yes. Has anybody looked at them? No. Okay, you want to look at your measurements as quickly as possible so you can fix the problem. So after this flight, we went down to Fargo. We took one of these handheld vacuum pumps. We went through the system and checked for leaks. So you take away the instrument, you go to your you take a tester, you test the instrument for leaks, and you find if there's any problems, and you find where the leak is. And then you check beforehand too. So for example, when we did installed the CCN counter in Saudi Arabia. We had a very difficult time getting it to not leak. And we had to go through the whole system and basically take all the things apart and check every part of it. And I had to go out there personally and spend a whole afternoon fixing that leaks in the instrument. The same thing, we got when I first got the instrument, unpacked it in West Africa, brand new instrument, it leaks. So just because it's new doesn't mean it's going to work, and just because it's working doesn't mean it's going to continue to work. So again, we remove these data sets, and then Dave makes this observation that you have a pretty wide span of relationships between the CCN and the PCASP. I think these are real. This is a variation that is believable, and it argues for the reason to do CCN measurements. If it was a nice one-to-one line, well, then you could just take the optical aerosol measurements and predict the CCN concentration. So there's two things that the OPC does not measure. It does not measure anything about the particles between less than 0.1 microns. So you could have high concentrations in that range. I mean, you have a distribution so that the 0.1s are affected and ones are larger are affected by that. So you have some correlation there. But you can have higher or lower counts. Also, where the peak of that accumulation mode aerosol is, a lot of times it will peak about 0.1. And if that shifts to lower than 0.1, you know, you might get a peak there where it will increase the CCN concentration but will not be reflected in the PCAS measurements. So it's how aged the aerosol is, particularly that peak moves with the age of the aerosols a lot. So, and the other final one is the chemical composition could change. You know, the chemistry is another part of it, which is probably secondary, but it also could change and affect the activation of the CCN. And doing this, the basic conclusion why I do this is I can, you know, we have to argue to the project managers. They would come and say, huh, you know, you got an extra instrument. Do you really need that? And I say, yes, we really need to make CCN measurements, is the conclusion from this. Okay, so that's the second topic. The third one, let's move on now from North Dakota. We'll go to West Africa and Mali. Look at some data here. This is a picture of, in the middle of rainy season, of Bamako, which is a city of several million people in central West Africa. If you look here, they a lot of times will get dust that comes in or dust events from the Sahara, and you have a lot of smoke and fires that can create aerosol pollution, and then you have the city itself. So there was a question there about how does the city affect the aerosol? Is it a big source of pollution? So that's a scientific question. We want to know how the city affects the concentration of aerosols. Is it a major effect, or is it something that's minor and we have a hard time measuring it? So that's a valid scientific question. They did a research flight. They took some data. And this is a quote from a feasibility study that was reported by NCAR for these about the pollution from Bamako. And so they quote here, so let me go back here and show you what we're measuring here. This is the size of the particle in microns. This is a combined spectrum. They don't say it, but they have to be using the FSSP data to get a combined spectrum with the PCAS. So you have from 0.1 microns up to 10, and you see this spectrum decrease here. And then you have this one here, and so there's two different cases, and we want to look at, so they want to look upwind of the city and downwind. And this is the upwind measurement, and this is downwind. And so you can see the difference, as they point out, is that right in here, you have very high concentrations of these small particles that you don't have in the upwind measurements. So they conclude here that probably due to city pollution. So this is most probably due to evidence of pollution by the city because the concentrations change by an order of magnitude. So big effect. Okay, so that's the conclusion based on this data. They also say that you need more measurements because this is only one study and stuff. So, you know, always need more measurements to verify this. So I want to go into some detail about the analysis of this flight. So this was the profiles I showed you earlier were attained on the 18th of August, 2006. This is a Google Earth image of Bamako is here. Right here is the airport. The city is located a lot on the, over here. This is the Niger River that flows through the city. So they took off from the airport, went out here, did these measurements, came back, did this measurement here, which is the upwind measurement, and then the red line goes through here and back over here. And then this is the downwind measurement, and then they came back and they returned to the airport. A couple of things to note, it ends right here because they turned off the data system. These are the roads that come into the town. And then we have the time periods here. If you look at the previous one, or remember it, I'll flip back, they give you the times right here of the upwind and when they took the spectrums, when they made the observations. So I took the first one, and that's what I denote on here. So this, they took two spectrums from down here and two up here. The other thing to note is that there's an important location at this time, 17, 19, 37 seconds. So I just want to point out where that point is because I'm going to refer to it in my next figure. So that's well downwind of the city. And then this is north and south, so the wind was basically coming like this on this day. Okay, so now let's take a look at the time series of data, about 1 hour of data, basically that same red area that I showed you before. This is a time series. This is not aerosol concentration. This is just raw counts from the instrument. There's a, to get the concentration, you have to divide by the sample volume. So this is just removing the sample volume, but it's, the sample volume is constant, so it's a one-to-one linear relationship. So these are 10 hertz measurements, 10 times a second of the aerosol counts, total concentration between 0.1 and 3 microns. So you go through here, and I want to ask you this. It's obvious something happened right here. So you have these measurements. There's a lot of scatter in the data because I'm giving you every data point at a tenth of a second. So there's a lot of scatter and there's no averaging of the data here. And then you can zoom in right here on this section of the time series. And you can look at the scale. These are less than 100. There's like 100 there. And then it jumps to 400 counts. Now this jump happens in a tenth of a second. Okay, the atmosphere, we mix the atmosphere. So here's my water bottle show mixing. So you got two fluids, they mix even when they're different fluids. It's hard to have a boundary that's distinctly different. So this has to be a very sharp boundary, which almost has, not an order of almost an order of magnitude if it's it's down around 40. So almost an order of magnitude jump in aerosol concentration. There's no way. I mean, one of the things this is why you need to know theory. There's no way that this could possibly happen in the atmosphere. So what happened, and then you can look at the instruments, and it's not clear from the ancillary data of the instruments, but this occurred for the rest of the flight, and something happened with the electronics, something happened with getting the instrument dirty, with the data acquisition system, I'm not sure. But I'm sure that this jump, because it's so abrupt, is not physically possible. So you can't believe these data. And that's the case for making a an edit, applying some, replacing this data here with a missing value code and saying, no, this is not good data. And then it would be another case that, well, after this flight, you should go and look at your instruments and check out what's going on with it. So again, here is the time, 17:19:37, that we had on the previous plot, which was well downwind of the city. So if the city was giving you pollution, you wouldn't have a jump that was well downwind of the city anyway. I mean, it would be a gradual change as you got downwind of the city. And so there might be something different here than there is here, but it's not an order of magnitude. So to be complete, I show you the same time interval and I show you the time series data of the GPS altitude. Because you can change because of altitude. And they probably could not fly low over the city. Even there, they don't like you to fly that low over the city, the ATC, the air traffic control. So they probably ascended in altitude as they flew over the city. And then they descended here. So they took the spectrum here, flew over, and then they were going to take another spectrum. But they took the spectrum out here, but they were well past the city, even in this point. And to put in the measurement again, here is my 17:19:37, which was well downwind of the city. So you can see these are basically the same magnitude, upwind and downwind. So the conclusion is the fact that this makes a difference. By not having quality control data, makes a difference to your scientific conclusion. It's not just the fact that, oh, you're worried about the 10th decimal place and it's not going to have any impact. If you analyze the data that is not quality assured, you can easily get different scientific conclusions. So I'd like to wrap up here by talking about one last subject, which is the software packages to help, because quality control, quality assurance of data sets requires a great deal of time. A lot of time in the field to make these measurements. So for example, when I was in Saudi Arabia, Robert Mitchell and Gökhan Sevier, they were there. They would go out every day to the aircraft, and I would ask them to do some quality assurance, quality control measurements. Well, I went and looked at the data and did other things. So, and every single day before we went on flights, we had something to do. We could have used more people, and we could have came up with more things. So you got to, you know, you have to have the personnel. You have to be there. You have to measure. You have to have enough personnel that are well trained to be able to help with the quality control to support all the instruments that you have. And you got to prioritize which instruments are really important. So it's very time consuming, and it's nice to have software tools like Sensor to do this, to quickly look at the data. Because you come up, you get up in the morning, you go out and you do your quality control checks on the aircraft, then you fly for 3 hours, then you come back, have dinner, and you gotta get up and do this whole thing again the next day. And before you fly the next day, you gotta look at your data. So if it's gonna take you another 12 hours, you just don't have enough time in a day. So you need these software tools. And that's what we do is we have a software tool that automatically post-processes the aircraft flight. So you want to look at it in real time, but you want to be able to process the data, get some preliminary data, so that you can put it into a quick review of the data and look at that data and make sure that everything looks okay and that you don't correct a whole field project's worth of data that's not good. So I've started an open source project called Airborne Data Process and Analysis. So this is hosted at SourceForge, which is a commercial site that allows you to upload software to their site. The software that I published there is licensed under the GUI General Public License version 3. It's an open source license. There's several of these. The package contains over 170,000 lines of code at this point, written in several different programming languages. We're just starting to do a lot of things in Python now. But most of it's written in IDL. We use the Subversion source code management software. So this allows multiple people to contribute to the code. So I'm working on getting not only graduate and undergraduate students that have already been developers on the project, but also people at NCAR and people from around the world that can contribute. And we can all work on developing the same set of software tools and processing code. We can sync code between systems. When we go out there, we have to process the data. I take at least 2 laptops. You've seen my other one where I had 4. We have a dozen servers, computers in the department that are in this software. How do you sync up all that software? You make one word of change. So the Subversion keeps track of all that. Whenever you want the latest version, you just update it. It tracks code and activities. Multiple people can write them on. You can revert back to changes. If you make a mistake, you mess something up, or you process the data at one date and you want to go back and reprocess it at the same time, all my data files have a timestamp when you processed it, so I can go back and recreate it because I know what version of code I ran that day. It has requests, bug tracking, form features all provided for you there. And we'll love to, I can show you more and talk to you about it. And you can go to the website and get that, look at the data, and see how the project runs. So a conclusion is problems can develop during field projects that are only detectable with robust quality control procedures, which means it helps to look at the data in real time, but you have to do some data checks, or else you end up with a whole summer of field measurements with an instrument that is critical to your project that does not work. You need knowledgeable scientists. I've been using, even undergraduates have worked with me. They can get knowledgeable on one instrument. I went over several different instruments now. It takes a long time to come up to speed just on one of these instruments. But you can do that. You can look for certain things. But it takes scientists. You cannot write a program to do this. If I could write a program to do quality assurance, I would. But that's why we need students. And we need knowledgeable students, knowledgeable scientists to do this. And you have to do it to get useful data sets. If not, if you don't do quality control and quality assurance, it results in incorrect hypotheses and beliefs of what occurs in the atmosphere, basically. So I know I kept you here, and we were a little bit late started, but I'll take any questions. We can go back and review stuff. It's fun to go out and make these measurements and take some good high-quality data, and you need to do that to publish high-quality research. So, okay, Dave. If the city was a pollution, if this was a big source of pollution, what you should see is that it will mix in from other areas. So, you would expect the concentration to be, if it's a very big source and it's a very big plume, it should be low, and then it should spike up, and then it should gradually fall off as you get away from the city. So, again, a reason to look at the time series and not just look at a couple of spectrums and a couple of data points. But
the spectrum that they produced, what time period did they use? Is it all the way from upwind to the downwind?
No, they just
where they're circling.
I assume it's just a short time period because they got 2 of them. They don't really specify it. But they got one here, and then they got one 5 minutes later. And these ones are 3 minutes apart. It's probably just a couple seconds of data at that time period. Yeah. So again, I mean, yeah, what I would do is you have to look at more than just a couple of data points. You have to look at the concentrations. But you could do the spectrum over a larger time period. And they should have, when they put the spectrums here, I mean, they did two of these. What they should do is a spectrum over an interval. And you would want to take an interval. If I was doing this and I want to reproduce the spectrums, I would take, you know, 3 minutes of data here and calculate a combined spectrum. And then make several spectrums downwind and see how it was.
How do you decide that, okay, if that location downwind, we're going to start certain
things? It was probably, it's a flight scientist decision. And it was probably based on some air traffic control issues, too, and where you could go. And also, you got to communicate with the pilot and say, okay, well, you know, we're going to do it upwind and downwind. And it's probably, if you looked at the ascent and descent, you know, they had to probably get away from the city enough before they let them descend. The other thing is they're probably talking to air traffic control. They try to get their clearance to descend. There's time to do that. So there's some problematic issues there of being able to make the measurements exactly where you want. But that's the other thing that the flight scientist does in the aircraft, is to try to get measurements that is as much idealized as you possibly can. You would want to try to get the same distance downwind. But
and then take the spectrum
of the whole path. Yeah. And they may have done that, but they were trying to do some spirals. And then again, you want to weld. The other thing I haven't talked about is you want a well-designed program of what you're going to do with your field measurements. You don't want to just go out there and say, okay, I got an aircraft. Let's go fly. Let's see what we can. You want to have very specific questions. And I'm not sure that they had this in their research plan, and if they did, how well they executed it, and how detailed they had. I mean, for example, I mean, you know, we have flight patterns, and you have to brief the pilots. Like when we do the test where we were testing the INRET, we had very specific maneuvers that we had to do, very specific time periods. Okay, we want to do this for this long, and we briefed the pilots on this. But then again, sometimes you don't get exactly what you want. You say, well, I want to fly north. Well, that's a little bit not the best place to go because there's a lot of planes taking off and going that way. Well, okay, we'll go a little bit northeast. So you move things, and then you have to work with the environment that you're in. West Africa, there's not many planes flying around there, so they usually let you do quite a bit, but they won't let you fly right over the city. You know, ideally, what I would have asked the pilots to do is do a low-level pass, do the same altitude over the city. And we talked about that before, and they got restrictions. They don't want the aircraft coming over the city, even when they're landing. Even the commercial ones, they vector them around the city or the population center. So. All right, lots of questions. We'll go away.
Previous slide, do you have a temperature sensor? A temperature sensor for this?
Yeah, we have temperature measurements on this.
Is there a variation in temperature as this could imply?
To be honest, I haven't looked. I kind of doubt it.
Suddenly, a plume comes, a different density.
Yeah. And I could look for that. I could look. For the temperature, but I doubt that there's any major temperature change.
And anyway, what's the peak in the middle?
Oh, this is because it probably corresponds to the altitude change. So, so if you see here, they change the altitude, and said there's probably higher concentrations higher up. There's probably an elevated dust rate or something. So
it matches up with that.
Yeah. So one of the things is, I'm just showing you the raw data here. If you're going to do the real analysis, I would do a concentration adjusted at standard temperature and pressure to try to remove that change in altitude. And also, so I would do that, but this could also very easily be an elevated layer of aerosols there. I've seen that on some cases. That's long-range transport. But again, that you could look at the profile of temperature. You can look and see if there's where the boundary layer is, how well mixed it is, and do some more analysis. So there's a lot more you should do on it. But to do all that stuff, you need to have robust software. And you know, I could take 5 minutes, and we could prod up the temperature data afterwards and do it. But it'd take me 5 minutes to look at the temperature data for this thing. But if you don't have the robust software, it could take you hours or days to ingest that data, put it into Excel or something, and look at them, answer them questions.
So you can get it really fast with the software?
The software on this one here, I just give it a data file. We create a summary data file. At this point here, we process all the data. We correct all the data together. And then I have this tool where I can basically, here's a temperature plot here. It's actually, the black is temperature and the blue is dew point. So you just bring it up into the GUI, make your XY plot. I can put in the start in time, which I have in the plots there, and prod it up, and it would take me 30 seconds to do it on my laptop here to look at that temperature. And you want to be able to do that because if you're after the end of the flight and you want to look at some of this, and that's what I would do after the flight, is I would see something like that, start looking at some of them parameters, look at the ancillary data, and try to figure out what's going on. So because the technicians, they are busy too, and I don't want them taking off an instrument and fixing it if it's not necessary. So for example, there's every time you change your instrument, work with it, there's a potential of breaking something. So we were, before our last flight in Saudi Arabia this spring, they removed the FSSP to clean it, and they basically crossed a couple wires and they blew the razor. And so the laser didn't work anymore, and they had to get a new razor, which means they had to ship it in, and we couldn't have the instrument for that flight. So you don't want to be monkeying with your instruments if there's not a reason, because there's a potential to damage something. And if you're interested, I can show you the software package afterwards. Jing Long.
Yeah, so I'm assuming that your optical part of the counter is designed for detecting spherical particles. I'm wondering what kind of cracking you want to make if the particles are not sphere, like gas particles.
Oh, yeah. The dust particles would be 1 to 3 microns. There's a couple corrections. Even the non-spherical particles, I mean, it's going to scatter the light differently. It's going to size them differently. The other problem with the instrument is the fact that it depends on the refractive index of the particle. So we have a similar instrument we use for the FSSP. Does a similar type of scattering, but there you have water where you know what the refractive index is. Here you can vary the refractive index quite a bit, and also particularly how much it has water on the particles. You can take the best refractive index representative. You can take spherical particle into account. The best thing I could say for knowing how well it works is they've done research and they've done projects where they've taken measurements from a PCASP and they integrate them, come up with the scattering and absorption coefficients using a refractive index by integrating that size spectrum and compare it to a nephrometer measurement. And I don't remember the exact results, but they got pretty favorable comparisons when they did this over the arm site in Oklahoma. So it's part of it is the first step on this is, you know, making sure the instrument is calibrated, taking into account refractive index, and non-seriality is kind of second or third on the down on the list. Yeah, you would have to know something about how the spheric is shaped, and it would be a hard problem to come back on. The other problem with this, the other reason why it's, there's another problem even, is the getting the particles in the instrument, how much inlet losses you have. There's other instruments that you can take the particles in, but you get a lot of inlet losses on them. So there's a lot of different instrumental uncertainties, and you have to check each one of them and then verify it each along the step by comparing it to a nephrometer. So that would be another quality control check you could do on your instrument, is if you really want to do a closure study where you're looking at an optical depth type of thing, you would want to use a nephrometer and verify that your size spectrum would do overlap with that. And how well it agrees, and also having some idea of the chemical composition, making some chemistry measurements so you get the refractive index. And then they do have some newer ones. That's a reason to develop new instruments to try to look at the non-sphericity of the particles. All right, Chris. How many different sizes? We typically use two. We use 15 and 30 microns. We ran them both through there. You can do more, and they both the 30 microns are actually better at seeing a change in the instrument than the 15. They seem to be more sensitive. It's a question of how much time you have. So I've standardized on two. The 15 are good because that's where the size of the particles that you are interested in the crowd droplets. The 30 seem to be more accurate, and they're better at looking at things when you want to look at a liquid water concentration, which is an integral property. So you want to get something that's up at the higher end. And it also seems that if you do have dust and optics on it, it seems to have more of an effect on the larger size particles. It's easier to see a change in the instrument with the 30 microns. But the 30 microns, there's another practical aspect is the 30 microns, you need more of them to go through there, and so they're more costly to use. These bottles of beads about $250, $300 a piece, and you could go through one bottle in a field project. So, you know, if you need to put that money in there to do it, but again, it's not an insignificant cost to do that. I tried to use, we tried this with the, maybe Mike suggested we look at, or had someone suggest to him, we looked at using pine pollen that's naturally produced, and that was scattering about 20 microns. And if you could use something cheap, that you could buy a big old bottle for like $10. And so I tried to use that. It seems to work a little bit, but it seems to get the instrument dirty too. It doesn't perform as well when you go through that it seems to stick on things on the optics. And the technicians, when we did this in Saudi, they did not like it, and they just said, no, we don't want that. So it did not work as well. I mean, you can see a nice peak there, but it gets a little wet or it sticks or something, and it's not quite as good. So I haven't found the cheap alternative yet.
What's the index of refraction of pine pollen?
I don't know, somewhere between 1 and 2. I don't know, but it doesn't. Well, as long as there's a standard.
You have to use it, wouldn't you?
No. All you didn't do is know that it changed. So you wouldn't use it to calibrate it. You just use it to change. So you would calibrate with this. But if you're doing a performance check, we're not recalibrating the instrument. We're not taking the measurements we make and applying them. We're just checking to see if the instrument is changing. And you could use anything that's consistent for that. You calibrate it, and then you check for the calibrations. And you know, as long as it's consistent, and it peaks always in 20 microns, you can look and say, oh, that peaks in channel 7. And then you just say, well, if it peaks in channel 7, it's fine. If it's peaking in 5 or it's peaking in 11, it's not fine. And then you would have to fix it and go back and do that.
This last, maybe the last question. You show is a concentration for the dust. Do you have a particle size? How large for the dust particle size?
The dust or the aerosols in general. We have these particle size distributions. So you will see, particularly, I forget who we were reviewing. I was looking at some. This is one that is from West Africa. It's also from, you see this in North Dakota. If you go and you look at the Saudi Arabian data where they have a lot of dust, you'll see a peak over here. You see the dust peak in the measurements. So I can tell you, I can look at the data and tell you if I'm in Saudi Arabia or if I'm in West Africa or if there's dust there and stuff. And that's one way to tell the difference between smoke and dust is you can look at the peaks. You don't see the whole spectrum, but you see the peaks, and then the FSSP will tell you too a little bit. So you can see when you have it and stuff like that. So any other questions? Questions? Last time? Well, before you end, I got one question for you. So do you think you should be doing that? So we have some fun out in the field. So after you get some measurements, you go out and you visit the camels and you pet them and see what they're like and you go visit the farms and stuff. So it's not our work. We go out and have some fun too. So thank you.
Scorch net.
Huh?
Scorch net.
Source
forge, yeah. This is a ghost distribution. You Chinese by one.